First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Activists calling to take them down are getting closer to victory. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, why one of the last big city statues honoring the Confederacy could finally soon come down. Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, bold plans to activate the downtown riverfront are moving ahead this month. We'll tell you how you can be part of that conversation. But first this hour, the city council could soon decide the fate of a monument to the Confederacy that is still standing in Springfield Park. Mayor Lenny Curry's administration says legislation will soon be filed to move this monument. It's going to cost around $1 million. Now, the announcement comes after months, actually years, of calls to remove the statue. Several activist groups have been part of this pressure campaign. Now, you might recall the statue of a Confederate soldier came down in James Weldon Johnson Park. At that time, at the height of Black Lives Matter protests in the city and the country last year, the mayor promised to get rid of all monuments and markers of the Confederacy. Let's talk to two people with so much skin in this game. They've been pressing on this issue for years. Ben Frazier of the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville is on the line. Hi, Ben.
Good morning to you.
Good to have you. Also joining us, Dr. Tammy Hodo of the consulting firm All Things Diverse. Dr. Hodo, good morning. Dr. Hodo, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, good morning. And already getting your calls, everyone. What are your thoughts about the news that legislation will soon be filed to take down a monument to the Confederacy in Springfield Park? 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa Injax. Dr. Hodo, I'd like to begin with you, since it's my understanding you were part of a committee that advised the city on this whole process. What's your reaction to this news?
Well, I think it's about time. People need to recognize that these monuments were put up after the Civil War, and they were put up with an intent to basically instill an ideal of where those of African American descent should be allowed and where they should not be allowed. Reality is that this monument was put up, again, long after the Lost War. The Florida legislature actually paid for more than half of the cost to put it up. And I know people are concerned with the cost, but reality is at some point it's going to have to come down. It is a really sad part of our American history. And as a veteran of the United States military, I find it despicable that it's still up.
Ben Frazier, Northside Coalition of Jacks. Now, the mayor has indicated through one of his staffers that legislation will go to the city council on this because it will cost about $1.2 million to dismantle this monument to the women of the Southland. The monument is covered up with plastic, but it's still standing. It's a very large monument in Springfield Park. And so rather than just ordering it removed, the mayor has put this to the council since there's now a budget decision to be made here. What are your thoughts about that, council approval now being required for this?
Well, it's going to take a supermajority, 13 out of 19 votes. Big question on the table right now is, will Mayor Curry go beyond mere lip service and political posturing and instead use every ounce of his power and leadership to get the council to pass this legislation? The question I ask candidly is, Mr. Mayor, are you going to stand up and truly lead this city into the bright sunlight of a new day? Or will we simply remember that campaign slogan, One City, One Jacksonville, as an empty campaign promise? Is he going to stand up and get the council to pass this measure? He can do it. He has the power. We all know it.
So you expect him then to lobby the council. Dr. Hodo, what about this group of advisors that met with the mayor's office on this, historians, art experts, members of the community, There was some discussion about moving this monument somewhere else because some people see it as an important piece of art. And so is that maybe why this has taken so long for this announcement to come?
I'm not really sure, Melissa, but I mean, we did indeed meet. We talked about the monument. We talked about the harm that it imposes upon people as we see that, particularly those of African American descent, to include myself. And we spoke about the need for it to be removed. We understand that people see it as an art form, but I think that people also need to recognize the damage that it does. You know, if we look at the monument, we see a woman with her two children, but people are not very empathetic in regards to what about these slaves that had their children ripped from their arms and sold off as property. So I think that, you know, ideally he has taken into consideration what we as the committee stated and requested, and that may be part of the reason that it has taken this long, but we've finished meeting quite some time ago, so the timeline kind of doesn't match.
Mm. Now, the report that was issued earlier this year said that these monuments must no longer stand as they have in celebration of the Confederacy, but that they could remain as historic structures. Ben Frazier, we don't know yet whether this monument will stand somewhere else, maybe in a private setting. We don't know the answer to that yet, do we?
I think what we need to address is why we want it moved. Listen, we get it. It's made of metal, marble, and stone. What's the Confederate monument doing to us? It's not really hurting us. I've heard that argument a million times before. Folks, this monument must be removed because of what it represents. Racism and bigotry. This city must begin to take a strong and courageous stand against racial hatred and injustice. That's what we need to hear this mayor talking about. We don't need to hear about politics. They need to take care of this monument and take it down. You want to talk to me about how much it costs? Well, let me ask you this question. How much money was made on the sale of 4 million slaves? How much money was made on all the cotton they picked? What about the price tag on all their blood, sweat, and tears? What about the trauma, as Ms. Hoda mentioned just now, Dr. Hoda mentioned, about parents and children being separated? Listen, in the end, the city is just going to have to pay the cost for the mistakes of the past. We need to acknowledge that racism is expensive, folks. But in the words of Frank Sinatra, that's life.
Let's go to some calls now as we talk with Ben Frazier of the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville, Dr. Tammy Hoda of All Things Diverse. As the mayor's office now says, they're going to file legislation and put this before the 19 members of the Jacksonville City Council to vote to approve moving, taking down a monument to the Confederacy in Springfield Park. It's quite large. It will cost over $1 million to dismantle it. By the way, it's not the only remaining marker of the Confederacy in the city left standing, although it's certainly the largest. 549-2937. Cliff on the west side. Hi, Cliff. Good morning. Cliff, go ahead and turn your radio down and let us know your thoughts. All right, Cliff, give us a call back. Philip on the west side. Hi, Philip. Good morning.
Good morning. Other than the issue with the statue, I would like to know if street names are going to be addressed in the future, such as Jefferson Davis and Stonewall Jackson.
Yeah, that was what I was referring to, Philip. Thank you for that. Dr. Tammy Hoda, there are other place names and such around the city that still bear traces of the Confederacy. Will you and Ben, will you continue to press on those?
Well, I definitely think that they do need to be removed. And people need to understand we're not at all trying to erase history. We acknowledge and we recognize the history of the past. And it was an ugly history for many people. But to uphold people who lost a war, again, as a veteran, I just struggle with that. to honor, you know, a lost cause and a lost war is amazing. So I do indeed think that those roads do need to be changed in regards to the street signs. And that's something that I think that citizens of Jacksonville should decide in regards to what the new names will be, but something that is not attached to the very racialized history of America.
Ben.
Bottom line here, Melissa, is that this Confederate monument, when you talk about art, it is an ugly example of how art has been used and manipulated to support racial hatred. Art should be used to uplift people, not to dismiss and disparage them. Now, this monument is speaking a language, a silent language. And what it's doing over there in Springfield right now is telling lies. It's telling us lies that slavery was good for black folks, and that the Civil War had nothing to do with race or slavery. This monument must be removed.
Lynn on the South Side. Go ahead, Lynn.
Hi, good morning. I'm really glad to hear you guys talking about this topic this morning. And I just, you know, when I heard, you know, somebody said it might be like over $1 million to remove the statue, you know, my first thought was, you know, I am pretty sure that if they put out a call and said anyone who wants to come and help dismantle this ugly, you know, reminder of our past, you know, you'd have a group of people that would take it down for free probably within a day or two, and they can cart it away in, you know, in trucks, you know, to the dump. And, you know, if somebody really wanted to keep this, you know, because they, for whatever reason, find it artistic, they can pay, you know, some private party wants to pay to preserve it. They can pay for it, but I don't think tax dollars should be, you know, involved in that. I agree with both of your guests today, and thank you for letting me weigh in.
Oh, thank you, Lynn. Here's a tweet from Jimmy. He says, I was under the impression SPAR, that's Springfield Preservation and Revitalization, was in favor of relocating the monument, but heard yesterday from a board member they don't have consensus. In my opinion, Springfield is better off without racist symbols and place names. Tammy Hodo, what about all of these points?
So I do understand that it is a piece of art, and it may be something that some people like, but I am concerned, and the board did express our concern about giving it over maybe to the Daughters of the Confederacy or whomever erected the monument, because we've seen before in other cities when that has taken place that people have gotten some farmland and re-erected the monument, and it becomes some type of very racialized shrine. So that's our concern with that, is that that's what will happen. And again, this is a very real, raw, ugly, racialized past of America that we need to not forget, but have real conversations about. But we don't need to continue to have the monuments up, which, again, were not erected until we had the Jim Crow laws put in place and after the Civil War was lost.
Mm-hmm. So but when they were erected, Dr. Hodo, when they were erected, this Mr. Newman put this up, he built it as a temple to the Confederacy. If you read his very words about the reverence he had, he said he built it like the Greeks built temples to God. This is the temple to the Confederacy. It should be dismantled.
Here's an email from Curtis. The city can get over half of the money to take it down that they just gave three city council members. That's a burn on the city council voting to give themselves American Rescue Plan money for their various nonprofits. Dr. Hodo and Ben, the city council isn't in the best place right now when it comes to public opinion. There is a fair amount of outrage about that move they made in the middle of the night, I need to point out, essentially voting without any oversight or due process to direct nonprofits that they control, federal dollars as part of the American Rescue Plan and such. Other nonprofits really aren't too happy about it. Some of them are afraid, aren't comfortable talking about it publicly,
right,
because they depend on the city for dollars.
I think you're right. But what that does is it gives us the overarching issue that we're dealing with here. What we're talking about is ethics and morality. And that's what goes through what happened on that night when they give that money to the city council folks and what we're talking about right now. Removing the Confederate monument must be based on a deep and abiding sense of justice and righteousness. Does Mayor Curry have that? Is he prepared to concede, to confess, to acknowledge, to accept that racism throughout American history was wrong and that that is what leads him to want to remove this monument? Or is it just the political posture he's making? We need to know that the mayor is going to stand up and lead us into the sunlight of a brand new day. He said one city, one Jacksonville. Is it real or was it just a campaign promise?
By the way, Ben Frazier on Facebook, Mary writes, will Ben Frazier run for the currently open city council seat? Referring to, I think, to the death of the late Tommy Hazzuri.
Well, Tommy was a friend of mine, and I assure you, I have absolutely no political intentions of doing any such thing. I'm flattered that she would say that. And we needed a moment of levity in this conversation this morning. Thank you, ma'am, for your sense of humor.
Wells Todd on the South Side. Wells Todd from the group Take 'Em Down Jack's on the line. Go ahead, Wells.
Good morning, Melissa. I think this statue itself is the most egregious one in this town because of I'm sorry, I just came from the dentist, so my mouth is kind of numb.
You got some Novocaine slowing your roll?
Yes, I know that feeling.
Okay.
Yes, I do.
We'll work with it.
Yeah. And what this thing represents also, what Tammy and Ben have already said, but it also represents the... what was used against African-American men, the Lost Cause and the Daughters of the Confederacy, all right, what they did to destroy Reconstruction, one of the tools they used was to say African-American men were brutes, they were ignorant, and what they wanted to do was rape as many white women as they could. This was used to chase black men away from the polls after their right to vote was taken from them. This was used, this egregious, foul thing that they used against the black community. They used it to destroy the black community. They used it to invade the black community. We know about at least 100 massacres that occurred and towns and communities that were burnt down because they would say, a black man looked at a white woman or a black man touched
including
a white
Rosewood in Florida. Yeah, people were lynched. The community of Rosewood, Florida,
lynched.
Was destroyed over these kinds of racist myths. And
exactly.
So, yes.
And that's why this statue out of the statues that are here is the most egregious, in my opinion, towards the African-American community.
Thanks for that, Wells, and I'm glad you got your dental work done. It's a reminder to us all. Let's all get that done. Cliff on the West Side. Hi, Cliff. Back with you now. Go ahead.
Hey, yes, I do not believe that the taxpayer should have to pay for this statue to be moved. Because in Florida, there is a lot of, I guess you could say, Yankee that live here. That's what everybody called me when I first come down here, as a Yankee. And, I believe that, we fought on getting the right thing done for the black community.
Thanks, Cliff. Okay, Tammy Hodo, this now goes to the city council. They need 13 of 19 votes, a supermajority. That might be difficult to attain, as others have noted, for a capital improvements amendment. Your thoughts about the next phase of this?
Well, I think it's important that the city council think about what empathy is, and that is putting themselves in the mental shoes of others. For those who feel that this should remain, provide some justification. You know, because reality is that if you put yourself in the mental shoes of others and you try to be empathetic, you will understand why we believe that the monuments do need to be taken down. And just remember the history of this country when the monuments were erected and the true intent of the monuments. It wasn't to celebrate art, but it was to celebrate oppression. And to continue to limit the rights of those, you know, of African Americans, and that's problematic. So again, I just ask that they think about this in an empathetic manner and consider their constituents and how this could, you know, basically impact their future in city council.
And we'll follow it. Thank you, Dr. Tammy Hodo of All Things Diverse and Ben Frazier of the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
And much more still ahead later in the hour, how a new type of mammogram now available in our area is using contrast dye to get a more accurate result. But up next, a look at the ambitious plans to activate the downtown waterfront. We'll be right back. Well, the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund is convening a series of conversations about how best to activate the downtown waterfront for the benefit of residents and visitors. And they've got a public presentation of their waterfront activation plan coming up later this month. We got a preview from Mari Qureshi, president of the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund, David Vandeleer of the cultural forecasting firm DVDL, and Claire Weiss of WXY Architects. Mari, David, and Claire, it's great to have all of you on the show. Mari and David, let's begin with you. What were the main goals of the Riverfront Activation Study and the plan that you've actually been working on since the beginning of this year? Mari.
So our goal at the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund was to work together with the city and other stakeholders in the process to reach as many, as broad a segment of the public as we possibly could, to help us as a community discover what we wanted to do at the riverfront. We see the downtown riverfront as one of the most logical places where we can maximize public access to the river. It is an amazing asset for our community, and we wanted to make sure that whatever we figured out to do with that waterfront would meet the needs of as diverse a public as possible. We were extremely happy to be asked to participate in this process because we at the fund are focused on placemaking and equity.
And David, the idea is to bring people and energy to the waterfront to activate the space. Your firm has brought a lot of thought leadership to this process. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, thank you, Melissa, and thank you for having the three of us for what looks like the last time we're chatting about this this project, which has been so exciting with you. It's interesting because, of course, like, people love being in public spaces, right? They're what makes our cities interesting. But sometimes you have to help them along a little bit, the spaces, I mean. You want to be sure that people understand and know what they can and cannot do in spaces, and entice them to come out and really use these spaces as individuals, as communities, and not just like once a year, but on an ongoing basis. So working with Marian the Fund and a group of like really interesting consultants, WXY, James Lima's team, it has been fascinating to see is like, what could we do in Jacksonville to make sure that this riverfront in the coming 10, 20 years becomes a much more vibrant place than it is already? And how could it become a place that everybody in Jacksonville feels they can go to? Which is not quite the case at the moment.
It certainly isn't. And the goal, too, is to have a diverse set of experiences, but also groups visiting the riverfront. How much did that factor into your planning?
Oh, like hugely. Of course, there's different ways to tackle a process, but in this case, a lot of the effort was focused together with, especially Groundwork Jacksonville, who have been amazing partners, on working through a very robust community engagement and stakeholder process. We ran a public survey with 3,100 responses from across the city. We ran community meetings and events with over 800 participants. We ran stakeholder groups, and our stakeholder groups include 51 organizations from Greater Jacksonville. And then there were public meetings also with several hundreds attendees at a time. So all to say is like the numbers are perhaps not even so important, but making sure that there is a solid process to think through like what is the value of public spaces, what is the value of like city space generally for all of us, for that a process is just really important.
And what when you heard from the public, what are the main things they want to see and do on the river? What's the most feedback you got?
Yeah, I can take that one also. It's interesting because, of course, there's a ton of content out there, and we'll be putting this up on the Jesse B. Boulder Pond website in the next days. But to give you a few interesting highlights, first of all, 19% of Jacksons go to the riverfront to enjoy green space and the outdoors. 19% is very, very low considering like how much river you have, so how much potential it has. And then perhaps also a good stat to throw in for the conversation, 59% of Jacksons never go to the downtown riverfront. Well, that's quite shocking, right? And then you start wondering, why is it? Why do people not go? Of course, there's options out there with the beaches, but it's not accessible necessarily for everybody. And what other reasons are there why people are not going out? Then in terms of like what people are asking for, that is actually quite amazing. Across the board, so coming out of that survey, people in Jacksonville are asking for better cultural, recreational, and also spaces for passive recreation on the riverfront. They want to prioritize parks, but they're not opposed to development, so that's important to note. And many people in Jacksonville, and that's where I should probably keep it at for this answer, many people are looking for gathering spaces, better gathering spaces to meet with their communities, but also to meet people that maybe outside of their communities and have a shared space on the riverfront.
Right. And people want programming on the water, but what about the design of the space? Claire Weiss, let's share some of your expertise about what is going to be part of this presentation, how to design the waterfront space.
Melissa, thank you. And I'm going to, because David really kind of honed in on some of the surprises in the survey, it's also, I think, really worth noting that that kind of wave of combination of cultural recreation and the word kind of excellent or beautiful or better when it came to parks and green space was a real kind of emphatic yes in many of the sessions. You know, luckily we got to attend a lot of sessions in person despite the hard, you know, how hard that was over the past year. But there is an ambition here for the recreation, the culture, and the green spaces, and as David mentioned, even more retail, commercial opportunities, development adjacent, or even right within the waterfront spaces to get a kind of dynamic and active waterfront that really feels downtown, and it also feels very Jacksonville to people. And sort of that is, I think, what's really worth pointing out, is that people are looking for an exciting waterfront that's beautiful.
Yeah. Let's go back to Mari Qureshi, Jesse Ball DuPont Fund. A big public presentation about this is coming up on October 19th. What will you be sharing?
We will be sharing our findings around programming, around design, and around how might we finance all of these things that people would like to see on the river.
Okay, and as we've heard from David and Claire, a lot will be going into that, but Mari, can you clarify for people too, what the DuPont Fund is going to be sharing is separate from the design competition that the City of Jax recently sponsored for the waterfront space. And a design firm out of Chicago won the contest with the metallic sculpture that some people have reacted very negatively to, some people have liked. But what you're doing is not that. This is a separate initiative. Can you explain that?
That is correct. Yes, it is a separate initiative. And what you're referring to is the old landing site. I think mm-hmm. it's now called Riverfront Plaza. And that was bid out. What we were asked to do in partnership with the city was to figure out what the conceptual design of the whole waterfront, downtown waterfront, from Memorial Park to Metropolitan Park on the North Bank, and on the South Bank, covering the Riverwalk controlled by adjacent to Baptist and the District. And in that conceptual design, we were trying to figure out what people wanted to do, and how might all of those things fit on the riverfront, because there are certain particularities of the riverfront. Let's say you want to kayak. Well, not all parts of the riverfront in downtown are appropriate for kayaking because of the currents. Some parts are. So kayak launches can go in certain parts of this riverwalk. Children's playgrounds can go in certain other parts. So it's really like a giant jigsaw puzzle. Or Tetris, whatever you would like to think of as the analogy. All the things we want to do, and how do we fit them on the river? And so that is a conceptual plan, not a actual engineering plan or even a design plan.
Now, as I mentioned, people can be part of this presentation on October 19th. It is a hybrid event. Just go to dupontfund.org/waterfront. So you want the public to continue to engage with this, Mari, and then once you present, how can you be sure the recommendations will actually be adopted? Certainly, this city has seen a lot of plans and renderings come and go. So what's the strategy there?
So, we are but a stakeholder in the process. There are many stakeholders. And what we have tried to do is really, so it's not the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund's vision for the waterfront. It's really the sum of all the different viewpoints we have received, along with some tools and kits that we hope will make it, the 10 principles that we came up with for the design of the shipyard space are principles that we hope that the city, and I mean here literally citizens of the city, can use to assess, future investments on the waterfront in downtown and say, yes, it meets the fun and functional or the flexibility principle that we have arrived at through listening to everybody. So again, these are tools, plans that we have brought together after listening to everybody. And we hope that it creates a path for consensus around the right mix and level of public and private uses of the river. And we have tried our best to make it as reflect perhaps unexpected voices in the dialogue. So it's, again, that's what we've done so far. it remains to be seen what we might be able to do to maintain some of this feedback loop process that we have put in place so that we can help the city and the community stick to some of the desires and plans that we've surfaced.
Everybody go to DuPontFund.org/waterfront and be part of this. The presentation is coming up on the 19th. Register, you can attend. And thank you, Mari Qureshi, Jesse Ball DuPont Fund, David Vandeleer with the firm DVDL, and Claire Weitz of WXY Architects. We look forward to it. Speaking of the river, algae bloom toxins in the St. John's River are raising serious concerns. Recent test results indicate the presence of harmful toxins. The St. John's Riverkeeper is out with new data this morning. Riverkeeper Lisa Reinemann is on the line. Hi, Lisa.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to talk to you. So tell us about these test results.
Sure. We've been responding to reports of blue-green algae or cyanobacteria in the St. John's the last week. And sadly, we're seeing high levels of toxins. In fact, in some cases, 300 times more toxic than safe recreational standards that are set by EPA.
Now, this is by far the first time we've heard the alarm sounded about blue-green algae in the river. How does this compare to other blooms?
You know, each one's different. What we're here, we're getting consistent, persistent reports throughout Duval County, and we're not seeing it from bank to bank like we saw in 2005. However, we are concerned because of the high levels of toxins near the shoreline, and that's where most people as well as pets can come into contact with this toxic material.
Sure. Now, your report also finds that the Riverkeeper's test results differ dramatically from water samples recently taken by the State Department of Environmental Protection. Is the state underestimating the health risks from these algae blooms?
Yeah, that is our concern. While we're very pleased that the Florida Department of Environmental Protection is responding to these blooms, they're sending out teams to test, their protocols require them to test below the surface, about a foot below the surface. And we worry that that's not, you know, showing the true risk, because most of us that come into contact is on the surface. And so if you take a true surface grab, we're seeing the toxins much higher. But of course, with cyanobacteria, it can be more toxic one day than the other. And so that is a concern. So a great rule of thumb is to treat all blue-green algae you see as highly toxic as our samples are showing they can be.
Yeah. These toxins can cause rashes, stomach cramps, nausea, respiratory distress. High exposure can damage your liver, your nervous system. Wash it off if it gets on your skin. Don't let your pets drink or swim in bodies of water where the algal blooms are present. Now, this algae, this kind of bacteria is naturally present in the river, Lisa, but what we're talking about are excessive nutrients. And as you talk about at the Riverkeeper all the time, they come from fertilizers, manure, industrial wastewater, and failing septic tanks. The city is working to get rid of old septic tanks all over the city, but there are so many other ways that we need to do a better job at not polluting this waterway. Can you talk about the education piece of this and why the St. John's Riverkeeper works on this all of the time, what the public needs to know?
Sure, most definitely. You know, this is nutrient pollution is the root cause of this blue-green algae outbreak we're seeing. And that's something we can all play our part to be more river-friendly, to reduce our own nutrient pollution footprint with using little to no fertilizer, planting native plants, picking up after our pets. All of these things, you know, making sure if you have a septic tank, it's functioning well. But in addition, we have to advocate for policies that require stopping pollution at its source. It's much better to prevent this pollution than try to get it out later, and much cheaper as well. And so that's why we work with trying to get better regulations, which we've successfully done in the past to some degree, but obviously with this outbreak, more needs to be done, including stopping the land disposal of sewage sludge, which is a major problem upstream from Jacksonville, but obviously has a negative impact right here in our waterways throughout the Northeast.
How can that be accomplished? What are the challenges to stopping that kind of disposal?
One is letting our legislators know that it's an unsustainable practice. We've been advocating with our elected officials at the state level to provide the same protections as South Florida. And right now in Putnam County, there's a significant permit that we're working with as an example that it just doesn't pay to move our pollution around. We're playing whack-a-mole with pollution instead of truly protecting our river and our waterways by stopping it at its source. But it takes political will at the state level as well as investment to make sure that we have new technologies to truly manage Florida's growing volume of human waste.
But this is whack-a-mole in a sense, as I think you said. There are so many threats to this waterway. That's just one of many. You've been moving on a number of fronts to keep the river at least somewhat clean. You know, a minute ago we were talking about the efforts to activate the downtown riverfront, which are ongoing. How do you see that whole initiative aligning with what you're doing? Because if we're going to be spending more time downtown on the river with more program spaces, it would make sense, wouldn't it, to have the river not be so polluted?
Most definitely. And when we activate our downtown riverfront, it provides us a fantastic opportunity to invest in green infrastructure. And so as we have more park space along the St. John's, throughout its 310-mile journey, you can actually use nature to help filter out and protect our river from pollution, from flooding. And actually, in normal conditions, it provides a wonderful open space like we're all longing to see in downtown Jacksonville.
With all of this said, what is the takeaway you want to leave our listeners with? Now, you mentioned all of the little things everyone can do to do their part, like picking up after your pet. Don't let pet waste be swept into the sewers. Bagging your yard waste, that's a big one. Isn't another one using lawn products that are more environmentally friendly? Doesn't that make a difference too?
Most definitely. I mean, one of the best things to do is to use plants like native plants that don't need fertilizer as well as they don't need irrigation. So it's good for water conservation as well as pollution reduction. But if you do fertilize, you'll use it sparingly, use nitrogen only, a slow release nitrogen is more safe, and definitely don't fertilize before heavy rains, which will wash it right down the drain and into our waterways. And so we can all do our part to reduce our nutrient footprint, but also, you know, water conservation helps protect our river. And big projects like the restoration of the Ocklawaha River, which we're working on right now, will help fortify the river's own ability to filter out excess pollution.
That's a conversation for another day, and I hope you come back soon to update us on what's happening with that.
I would love to, Melissa, but I would like to stress that it's very important right now to stay safe and make sure everyone's staying clear. If you see green, kind of fluorescent green scum on the waterways, stay clear of it and also report it to the Florida Department of Environmental Protection or contact us at stjohnsriverkeeper.org for more ways to protect yourself and reduce pollution in the St. John's River.
Right. Let's all do our part to reduce the green monster, as it's called. Lisa Reinemann, she's the St. John's River Keeper. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Take care.
You too. And in a moment.
I am absolutely giddy about this technology, to be honest, because it has so many potential implications for really helping a lot of women in the area.
Using contrast dye to get a better mammogram, we'll tell you where you can get that done locally right after this.
Dr. Talithia Williams, host of Nova Wonders, math professor, and passionate STEM advocate, will be the morning keynote speaker at TEACH on Saturday, November 13th at the Hyatt Regency Riverfront. Hear from Dr. Williams and some of the best local educators at this day-long conference for educators of all grades. Visit wjct.org/teach for tickets.
Next time on The World, the long journey out of Haiti. People left their island nation years ago, worked their way through South and Central America. Now they're stuck in Mexico.
Porque imagínate, yo gasté todo lo que tenía, regresa a Haití ahora, ¿cómo va a vivir?
This Haitian woman says she spent everything to get this far. Why going back to Haiti is no longer an option. Our story from Southern Mexico on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Jane Clayson. Here's a question. Does your job define you? Writer Arthur Brooks makes a case for why it shouldn't.
If you are a human that's defined by work, if you objectify yourself with respect to your job, you're frankly going to miss most of the important things that can make you happy.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
It's been said that the difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion is the thickness of a prison wall. New reporting from an international collaboration goes some way to confirm that corporations and the super wealthy have stashed away trillions that's either untaxed or taxed at a very low rate. The latest revelations from the Pandora Papers, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
It's a cutting-edge breakthrough in breast cancer treatment, CEM, or contrast-enhanced mammography, using a special dye. I learned more from Dr. Galen Scuderi at Ackerman Cancer Center. Dr. Scuderi, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate you having me.
So as we look ahead to Breast Cancer Awareness Month, this is exciting new technology here in our area. Tell us about CEM, contrast-enhanced mammography.
Well, contrast-enhanced mammography is, you said it, super exciting. I am absolutely giddy about this technology, to be honest, because it has so many potential implications for really helping a lot of women in the area. Detect breast cancer early, of course, and more importantly, cure breast cancer, nip it in the bud, and really save a lot of lives.
So this is like a regular mammogram, but it gives much more detailed results, it looks like, based on the images I'm looking at, because you use a contrast dye medium. Is that injected into the patient's bloodstream before the mammogram so that you can better see abnormalities in the breast tissue?
Yes, exactly. So the contrast-enhanced mammogram is really very familiar in a way to patients because it feels just like a regular mammogram, with the exception that just before the mammogram, they have an intravenous catheter placed, an IV catheter, and they receive a less than 1 minute injection of iodine-based contrast. It's the same type of contrast that's used for CT scans. And that contrast gets taken up by the breast tissues. And similar to the same kind of process as a breast MRI, which is also a contrast-enhanced exam, the tissues in the breast that may be nefarious or malignant, they typically have abnormal blood flow and abnormal blood vessels that are leaky. And that contrast agent will leak out at a rate that's different into the interstitium and into those masses that are malignant. It'll leak out at a rate that's different than how the contrast is taken up by the more normal breast tissue surrounding it. And what you're left with is this image that shows only the things in the breast, only the masses or abnormalities that were enhancing above and beyond the rest of the normal breast tissues. It adds this this ability to clarify the dense breast tissues and subtract them away.
How
so
did
only see what's abnormal?
that you only see. How did Ackerman become, or are you the first purveyor of this diagnostic tech in Jacksonville? How did you come onto this?
Well, this technology has been around for it's not super new. It's been around for about 10 years, FDA approved since 2011. But as the data and as the research has emerged in the medical community, it's become more and more clear that this is a big player in breast cancer early detection, especially for women with dense breast tissue and especially for women who have elevated risk, is how I'll put it, any women that have higher than average or high risk. And as that data has been emerging, it's something that to me spoke to me as someone who sees a lot of women who could benefit from a deeper level look into their breast tissues, understanding, of course, that dense breasts really decrease the sensitivity of traditional 2D or 3D mammography and decrease the specificity of those exams as well. So I see a lot of women who can benefit from either a breast MRI or now a contrast-enhanced mammogram. And I have been kind of enchanted with the concept of this technology for a few years now and really been advocating that we bring it on as a part of our service line so that we can offer something new to the Northeast Florida community, something that gives patients options.
So women who qualify should have a physician referral then to have this procedure done?
Yes, this does require a physician order and a physician evaluation. It is a diagnostic test. It's not a screening exam like a traditional screening mammogram. But I think that this is a good opportunity to make sure and highlight that just because this is an excellent exam doesn't mean that screening mammograms, traditional screening mammograms, are not still important. With Breast Cancer Awareness Month coming up around the corner in October, I think it's imperative that we highlight that screening mammography has been and still is the gold standard for early detection of breast cancer before it is clinically recognizable, mostly because it has reduced breast cancer death by at least 30% to 40% in the last few decades that it's been in play as a national screening initiative. Every woman should have a screening mammogram every year. And for those women who present for a diagnostic CEM as a part of their annual exam, they receive a regular mammogram as a part of that test. It's a kind of a test that's sort of like a two-in-one test that includes a regular mammogram as well as the contrast-enhanced mammogram.
So check it out, folks. CEM, contrast-enhanced mammogram at Ackerman Cancer Center. Dr. Galen Scuderi with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day. Be safe, everyone.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.